I don't know what to say. The monkeys won't do. And I also don't know what to say about those crazy producers from the Geek Cop Radio Network. They're driving me crazy.
Hello and welcome to episode 217 of the Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me, as always, is the Comic Concierge. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. We're into, I guess, the summer months in Florida, and that means it's hot. So I tried to mow the yard the other day and got about halfway through. Mowing the yard and like trimming and weed whacking or whatever you want to call it in Florida, I have found, is like a 3-day process. You can do like half of your yard one day, half of your yard the other day, and then you can trim a completely separate day. But doing them all on the same day is not ideal. The only benefit I have is when I'm done and there's sweat pouring out of every pore in my body, I can just belly flop into our pool, and it's like the most satisfying thing you would like on the planet. That's good, I guess. And I look around at all the people that are much more well off than we are, that have people that come and do all of that stuff. And I'm like clinging to like the fact that I still mow my own yard and I'm trying to like hold out as long as possible.
Yeah.
So anything new? The kids were just about done with school, I would imagine.
Yeah. Nearing the end of that. And I'm in Maryland, so it's not as hot as Florida, but it's stickier. You know, Maryland is, you know, it's basically most of it used to be a swamp. So it's like walking, you know, when it's midsummer, it's like walking around microwave cobwebs, because it's just like you're always feeling gross. So
yeah, I can imagine. Baseball season is in full swing. I only bring that up because I had predicted that your Baltimore Orioles would be much better than they are currently.
And... oh, there's a baseball season this year?
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have reminded you. So the Cubs, however, which is my team, are actually doing pretty fantastic. So I guess we'll ride that wave as long as we can.
Yeah.
And see where that's going. I think the NBA finals are happening, so it's a lot of sports stuff happening right now, but we're not here to talk about sports. We're here to talk about movies. And like we've done for the last 12 or 13 episodes, let's see, this has got to be episode 13 in this series, I believe, of our Alfred Hitchcock retrospective. We are moving on. We did Rebecca and Suspicion were the last two that we did in kind of our bonus territory of the, as we decided to extend this filmography look. And now we're into 1943's Shadow of a Doubt. Before I go over some of the information about the movie, just to reiterate what we talked about at the end of last episode, Dan, neither one of us has seen this, and you have no knowledge of what the movie was going into it, right?
Yeah, I knew nothing about it going in. I never watched it before, so completely fresh for me.
All right, so this is a American psychological thriller film noir, if you want to believe the all the descriptives that Wikipedia gives it. I should definitely find a different source that like narrows that down, because I feel like sometimes they just like throw as many genres and subgenres at the title as possible. But this is obviously directed by Alfred Hitchcock, starring Teresa Wright and Joseph Cotten, among some other folks. This came out, like I said, 1943, and this is about a small town. I guess you would call it a small town outside of New Jersey. No, they start in New Jersey. They end up in Santa Rosa, California. And this movie is kind of depicting that town of Santa Rosa, and definitely a more of a Andy Griffith style town, you know, a small town situation, where they're going to look at that a little bit, and we're going to follow the tale of two Charlies. We have a Uncle Charlie, who's obviously an older, not older, but like a middle-aged gentleman. And then we have a younger female Charlie, who is his niece, to try to make that as confusing as possible as we talk through this, and probably use the word Charlie as many times as they did in the movie, which I think was like 171 I saw somewhere. So this was released in January of 1943. It had a 108-minute runtime. The reason this one made it into our bonus coverage was a couple different reasons. Number one, this is one of those rare films that actually has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So that was interesting, or intriguing, I guess, as far as that goes. And then it also had one Academy Award nomination, and it showed up on almost all the different lists I looked at. It was ranked number 9 by Independent, Ranker Den of Geek, number 8 by IndieWire, number 5 by Taste of Cinema, and number 11 by on the Screen Rant list. And also, this was said to be Alfred Hitchcock's favorite film. So we thought, if it's his favorite film, if it's 100% in Rotten Tomatoes, if everything that is written about this film seems like it's positive, we should probably take a look at Shadow of a Doubt. So with all of that lofty expectation and kind of rhetoric around this film, Dan, what was your take? And I cannot wait to get into this because I think this is going to be the one, but what was your take on Shadow of a Doubt?
Shadow, it's interesting watching this after Suspicion because there's a lot of similarities with these two films. Obviously, Suspicion, the big difference is with that, we don't know the answer. You know, it's all about this fear of guilt, this fear of understanding, like, what is this person doing? Are there sinister actions and seeing those be discovered? Because, like, you're, you know, that's where the suspense is coming from. Here, it's the opposite, where we know more than most of the characters. We know this guy is guilty. We know he is certainly running from doing some awful things. And, of course, now he is within this family that seems like it is, like, the picture-perfect type of household. Like you mentioned, Andy Griffith's a good comparison. You know, this is in the 40s. It seems like it's kind of representing the ideal of what the American family could look like. But underneath, you have this ugly underbelly that is potentially going to rise up and destroy it from within, which is interesting comparing, considering this is coming out in 1943, you know, during, you know, the, I don't want to say height of World War II, but certainly that's in the background. We see it a little bit throughout. And I didn't know all the praise of this going into it. Like, I know like some of it. Like, I knew, like, obviously it's Hitchcock film. It's obviously praise, but I wasn't sure where it felt on the pantheon of movies. And I think there's a lot I really like about this, but I don't, like, you mentioned it being his favorite film. You know, some people rank it near the top. I felt like I didn't have as much suspense with this compared to that of what we just went through with Suspicion. And I was trying to figure out, like, why that is exactly. Like, there's, you know, I see so much praise for this film as after I watched it to see, like, you know, there's a lot of admiration here, and especially for the actors and, like, how well it's put together. And I think, you know, there's certainly, like, I do like the juxtaposition of, like, this idyllic household and seeing that kind of crumble because, you know, it's kind of a facade, and see that going through. But I think it also has similar issues to, like, the what we had with Rope, where you had, like, just a lot of, like, depraved characters that were hard to invest in. This, at least, we had the girl, Charlie, who obviously was, like, the innocent, the person trying to figure it out. But I don't know. Like, I struggled at times. Like, I wasn't as, you know, like, this is a movie that is a thriller at heart, and really, until there are some moments that worked for me. There are some, I think, some brilliant moments from Joseph Cotten. Like, there's a moment where he talks about kind of his hatred of women, which I thought was, like, rather chilling, and, like, it's like, wow, he must go on 4chan message boards because it seems very similar to that. Right. But as an overall, like, clearly a well-made film, but if I'm comparing it to what we say before, I don't, like, it's not my favorite Hitchcock film. I didn't walk away from it as, with this admiration I had for some of the other films we've done so far. So I guess I'm a little bit more in the middle with it compared to, you know, some of the other films we've reviewed.
Dan, how long do you think, do you have any clue of, like, the first year that we reviewed a movie together?
Oh man, I want to say 2011, 2010.
So it's, I mean, we have to be getting close to 15 years. Like, yes, there's been breaks and there's been, you know, years where we've covered more films than not, and maybe some years that we didn't cover any films. But I feel like we've been reviewing films or talking about films for a long time. And you have I feel like you definitely have a good sense of the types of films I go for and things of that nature. And I have a little bit of, you know, obviously a sense of what you like and stuff like that. And when you're going through an older filmography like Alfred Hitchcock filmography, that's, you know, we're going from the 1930s into the mostly the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's a little bit different because it's not something modern, and it's not something that relates to like some of the stuff that you're covering when you're trying to cover all new films like we did for many years. So it's a little bit harder to predict. And every time I feel like we finally approached one where we're going to have like completely differing opinions on it, I let you go first and you shock me, because we're almost always in lockstep. Like, there's some films that you've clearly liked a little, like a different, maybe a little bit better, or some films that you've not liked quite as much, but I feel like it's just like degrees at that point. It's not like you loved a film and I hated a film type thing. Yeah. And I just find that kind of interesting. I thought for sure that this one might be the one that we differ on, but it's not sounding like it's going to be that way. I have a lot of problems with this film. I do, like you said, let's start with the positives. I do think that the idyllic American town / American family is definitely well depicted. And I think it's a good job by, whether it be the screenwriter or Hitchcock in the direction and whatever, is setting that up and really showing us how that looked in a way that seemed sincere and authentic, and still was kind of like a time capsule of a certain time and place. And so I really enjoyed that. I also come from a very small town. Like, we didn't have stoplights in my town. My graduating class was like 60. I was like in the most Caucasian part of a state that you could possibly be in, and just didn't have a lot of diversity of race, cultures, or anything. So like, I can relate to some of what we're seeing in this film, and I think they do a very good job of depicting that. I think we do get some good performances from the cast, and I do really love a couple of the supporting characters. And before I get into overall thoughts, I do want to correct myself, because last episode I looked at the cast list and I basically said like, there's nobody I know in this cast, and there's nobody that I recognize. There's no names that I recognize. So I'm not only going into it blind from a plot standpoint, but I'm also going into it blind from any expectations from the actors and actresses. And I just didn't realize that I just didn't recognize some of their names, but I definitely recognize some of their faces as far as what they've been in, like Teresa Wright, who plays the younger Charlie. I mean, she's coming off of 3 Academy Award nomination films in a row right before this. So if you've seen stuff like, I've seen her in like The Pride of the Yankees was the one that I most remember. I don't think I've seen Mrs. Miniver or The Little Foxes, but she was obviously very well received coming into this film. Joseph Cotten, who was a little bit more known by the time this film came out, was clearly in Citizen Kane. So I feel bad that I didn't recognize that from the get-go. And I believe Hume Cronin was a name that I just didn't see the first time going through the cast. This is his first film, and that's a name that I recognize. He did a lot of stuff in TV and films afterwards. So there's definitely, oh, and the angel from, what's the Christmas movie that has the guardian angel?
Wonderful Life.
Yes, it's A Wonderful Life. The dad is the guardian angel from A Wonderful Life, I'm pretty sure. So, so there was some people that have definitely done some stuff. This isn't like I didn't want to come across as I was saying, like it's a bunch of nobodies or people that nobody knows. Like, I was just ignorant to the names on the list. So I did want to point that out. But overall, I think you nailed it on the head when, and I don't know if it was just like unfortunate that we, in a way that we watched this right after Suspicion, because I definitely do, just like you, see a lot of the parallels between these two films. And it's tough coming off of that one to see this one, where I feel like a lot of the things were done better in Suspicion. And I know some of that is just how it's set up. Like you said, in Suspicion, we're not sure, right? Like, we're walking the line of not knowing if Cary Grant's just coming across as somewhat despicable, or if he actually is despicable. And if he is, like, what level is it? Is it just kind of like some juvenile or like meathead frat boy type despicable, or is he an actual murderer, right? Like, so we're balancing that line a lot with Suspicion. And I feel like this one, I feel like it wanted to do that, but it didn't, because I don't know if it was intentional or not. Like, Rope is different. Rope, we see the murderer, right? Or we see the act right at the beginning. Like, there's no doubt, we know. And I'm not sure if this one was trying to do the same thing where we know, like you said, more than the characters, and we know for sure whether he's guilty or innocent right from the beginning, or if it was trying to do what Suspicion did and then just did a poor job of it. I'm kind of wrestling with myself a little bit about that, because part of me was kind of coming out of this one and saying, you know, Joseph Cotton, as well as he performed in this and whatnot, is not Cary Grant. And what I mean by that is, like, Cary Grant, because of his charisma and presence and whatnot, I feel like was able to pull off the fact that you're in one second you're despising him, but in the next second you're believing that somebody could fall for him, and you're kind of going back and forth because of who he is as that actor, and through his performance, I think he's balancing that line in a different way. And in this one, and it's written that way, I'm sure, and directed it that way, but Joseph Cotton is, there's no doubt when he's bad and to what level that he's bad. Like you said, the speech that he gives about women, there's a few physical moments where he's like actually hurting the younger Charlie by the way he grabs her and things of that nature. There's a different look in his eye that is definitely evil. If you look at the movie poster of this film, like, it clearly is showing him as evil in the shadow depiction of like what he looks like in the background. So I don't know. Part of me was just thrown off by that, because I couldn't determine if they were intentionally telling us that he was bad, or if they were trying to balance that line and just doing a bad job of it. Do you think they were intentionally letting us know that he was bad?
Yeah, I think, because in the beginning, we see him running away from the police. Like, he has that little internal monologue where, you know, he's like saying that, like, they don't have anything on him. I think, like, we know he's running away from something. Mm-hmm. And when he cuts out the article from the newspaper, clearly to like try to hide what's happening, I think it's pretty clear. Like, I think, you know, we're supposed to know, you know, he's this killer. He's who they're looking for. You know, his refusal to get pictures taken. He would hate today, man, because like
can't so, go so anywhere. Then it does, like you say, kind of go back to that rope situation, then, where we're supposed to be in a suspense that we're the only ones that aren't in a suspenseful position. And to me, I don't know if that works for film. Like, maybe if it's done in a certain way, but it really takes me out of the suspense if I know that he's bad from go. And to me, there was no doubt in my mind as I'm watching it that he's bad. Like, I was never questioning, like, well, maybe it's just something that's being made to look a certain way. And then at the end of the movie, they're going to like pull the tablecloth out from, or whatever this phrase is, pull the rug out from underneath us. And we're all of a sudden going to be like, oh, they tricked me and he's not bad. So I just thought it was very obvious that he was bad, and I don't know if that helped me. And then the other thing that was, I feel like, was a mistake maybe in the screenplay, but I don't know how, you'd have to completely rewrite the movie and it'd be a completely different movie, so I don't know if that would work. But he is introduced as Uncle Charlie to this family, right? And we have the young Charlie, who is his niece, and then she has an additional younger brother and younger sister, and then her mom and her dad. So we have a family of five here. And they definitely depict her as the one that is very much in favor of her uncle. Like, she is in his camp at the beginning. It's like the uncle that you wish visited more, and when they finally do, like, you're jumping up and down and you're excited, or that family member, whatever that case may be. Like, she's definitely... I don't want to make it more incestual than the movie did, but she's like head over heels about this guy coming to her family. She feels like her family, like she's bored of Mayberry, and she wants something to shake it up. And I think she sees that as a way. And then obviously she must have some type of previous positive experience with him.
Yeah.
And not saying that anybody else in the family is not excited. Obviously the mom, Uncle Charlie's sister, is excited, but they really play it up with her. And then I feel like because of that, it's almost a mistake that she's the one that knows he's bad first and throughout a majority of at least the second half of the film, because I feel like it would be much more effective if the family is the one that is seeing the little seeds of something, or her younger siblings or the detectives or somebody, and that's trying to convince her, and she can't see it because she's, you know, so enamored with this relative, and that it takes like some type of dramatic event towards the end that finally gets her to see the light or something of that nature. And instead they do the flip and she's the one that knows that he's bad. So it kind of deflates all of that excitement. And it's more about whether she's going to tell the family and things of that nature. So that like part of it for me felt like it was a miss. I don't know. Like, what did you feel about her being the one that knows, and then her relationship with the rest of her family and her not wanting to like let anybody know besides herself and the powers that be?
I thought it worked, because to me, like, the reason why it works is because she has the innocence to her, right? Where it's like she has this admiration, and also there's also the fear becomes if she does discover this, what happens next? Like, like you mentioned, like, there's no suspense because he's bad. But I guess to me the question was, well, what is his level of depravity? Like, how far will he go to protect himself? Like, will he hurt her? And, you know, that was a question that was looming. And then we start to see that, yeah, he will go that far. Like, some, you know, when he cuts the step to try to, you know, and that to me became kind of captivating, because you see here go through this system of, like, you know, no, he's fine, and that development me worked, because if it was the other way around too, especially with like the mom character and the dad, I don't know how that would play out in the sense of them trying to convince her, especially because the mom seemed more,
yeah, like, I don't think it works with the parents. I was thinking, yeah, more like the siblings or the detective or one of her friends or something like, yeah, that.
I think
the mom's gonna believe him no matter what, almost.
It had the strongest connection, so attacking that, you know, making her have to reconcile with that feeling, because it made the most sense that she would try to find every way out that it's not true, and then having to, yeah, deal with it being true. Like, I thought that was one of the more compelling parts of the movie, and then that's really where it did start to pick up with me, because you saw that, you know, once he realized that she was no longer trusting him, like, he started to, you know, go out and basically, right, you know, kill her too. You saw that, like, that it was completely like gone. Where it lost me a little bit though is when, like, we suddenly get this random love story with a police officer. Like, that, like, felt very tacked on. That kind of shows up and then never really comes back again. Yeah. But I thought, like, their dynamic to me was the strongest part of the film, and that worked for me.
Yeah, I do think their dynamic worked. I was wondering if there was a way to get more tension out of it, because I think the only tension for me comes towards the end, when you're trying to figure out, if is he going to be successful in his attempts to kill her? First, if he's going to go that far, and then once he does, like, is she going to be able to escape these attempts? Is she going to survive? Is, you know, he going to get caught? Yeah. Like, that's where the tension comes in, like, maybe that last quarter or last third, which I do think is somewhat effective in the way they do that. It does beg the question, though, because from, like, a plot standpoint, like, going into a third act, you typically have, like, your main character that has to make a decision on something. Like, they have to make some sort of decision. And obviously, yeah, her decision is whether she tells her family or tells the police or tells, you know, everybody else what she has already figured out. And I feel like it approaches that question like three or four times, and every single time she's pretty adamant that she's not going to tell anybody. And yeah, she tells him that at least on three different occasions, and it becomes questionable why he doesn't just leave. Like, I feel like at one point she's, you know, he's tried it multiple times. She's very sincere that she doesn't want her mom to be, you know, broken by this. She's not going to tell anybody. And he has an opportunity to leave and just get away with it and continue his run. And he decides, I guess that's kind of going into the psychoticness of his character, because we're definitely supposed to think he's a psycho, a madman, yeah, that's been afflicted from a young age, et cetera. So I guess that goes into, like, he has to have some type of power reason to continue on and stay there versus leaving. But just to go back to your detective situation, I thought that was a problematic scene as well, because we have like this montage of her and the detective going out and enjoying a night or an evening together. even though we're set up to believe that he's mainly trying to get information out, but it clearly becomes more than that. And then, like, without any sequence to set it up whatsoever, it just cuts to her accusing him of being a detective with, like, no reason for that. Like, there's, it doesn't show any, like, breadcrumb to that. It doesn't, like, set that up at all, like, to where she would think that. But she completely comes to that conclusion out of nowhere, out of this montage. And then it's like, oh, well, you're a detective, and now I'm angry at you and things of that. Like, there were some weird dynamics between her and the detective, which I forget the character's name, but I'm definitely with you on that. What did you think about the Uncle Charlie not leaving?
I did wonder about that. And I think part of it, like you said, was that element where I think he liked that conflict. Like, it does seem like it's something this was a challenge for him, and that's something he saw. Plus, I think he likes this opportunity that he was in, because he knew that there were some widows nearby that he can take advantage of. And I think he felt kind of safe and protected, because he can have this, his idea of a family man or being a part of this family. So I think that might be why. Like, I don't know. I think it's a valid point, saying, like, it seems like when he gets to the point where she knows she's talking to detectives, logically you'd want to step away. But perhaps he also thought if he did go away, then he'd become a bigger suspect. And then we get that little bit where they supposedly catch somebody. So it's like, okay, right. No longer at least did some recognition of it, saying, okay, we need something here. And when he's no longer, or supposedly, when they catch the guy they're looking for and he's no longer having to worry about it, okay, maybe that makes more sense. But yeah, I could understand that flaw, like where that comes from. But
it's also definitely a little bit of a time capsule, because you have this situation where there's one person that ran to the east and one person that ran to the west, and they're trying to track down both of these individuals, and they're trying to get a picture of him so that they can then wire the picture to a witness in another area of the country, get confirmation that it's like, it's so like of that time. Like, it's kind of fun to think about, like, the logistics of how things happened prior to the time we live in, where obviously none of that would have been necessary. So it's definitely interesting. It's also interesting that the detectives, like, their whole game is to follow him all the way to Santa Rosa, California. And then instead of just going and, like, questioning him or arresting him or anything, like, they pose as, what was it, a newspaper, a magazine?
Yeah, they were doing an article about, like, the, like, the average American.
Yeah, so they're going to, like, get in the house and take pictures, and then, like, mysteriously or slickly take a picture of him. And, I have never seen detectives act like the two detectives in this story do, but I guess that's what the plot needs.
Yeah. I mean, they were creative, I guess. They got the job done. They got the picture, and then he had the little sleight of hand with the film,
Which was done, I guess, yeah. I do have a couple other things. I know this is, like, it's completely nitpicky, but there's a sequence when he gets to this house. I don't know if it's the first night that they're the first dinner or the first night that they're together. I can't quite remember. But one of the first times that he's with his, reacquainted with his family. And we have, like what you mentioned, the newspaper, which is on the table, dad's newspaper. Right. And there's an article about this killer, and Uncle Charlie loses his mind. Right. And he has to do whatever he can to get this newspaper hidden. So he, like, tears at it, creates a house or a farm or a barn or something out of it for the kids, which was interesting. I was there for that. I was trying to see what he was going to create. But to me, that whole thing makes zero sense, because there is no picture of him in this newspaper, because nobody has taken a picture. That's why the detectives are here, to try to get a picture of him. So there's nothing in this news article that's going to implicate him to anybody. Like, nobody in that family is going to read that article and then look at Uncle Charlie and be like, hey, there's a killer. like he was freaking out for absolutely no reason, which was somewhat problematic to me, because it's a big part of this plot. Like, they follow this newspaper for scenes. Like, there's two or three scenes that include this newspaper. She goes in to try to find it. She has to go to the library to see what was on it. Like, it's a big deal, and it made no sense for him to draw attention to that newspaper whatsoever. He was not a very slick, psychotic killer. I will say that much.
I think that is part of it, like the guilt or the fear, though, right? It's where, taking over. He he's worried what it could lead to, because you know, there is indication of like that person's on the run. He suddenly shows up and he starts putting all these things in his head, and even in, like, in that opening scene, you could see like he clearly was paranoid, and you know, in the sense of people were after him because they were actually after him because he murdered people. But I think that I agree, like, logically it doesn't make sense, but I think for that character it
does.
Yeah, because it, as we in it one, it cues us into where he is as a person. Like he is super protective of everything. Like, he is overprotective.
Yeah.
The point of where it makes it kind of it to his detriment. So I think it was consistent with the character, even if it wasn't logical.
Yeah, he definitely wasn't like he wasn't the slick killer. We'll say that.
No.
Like, he does a number of things that the slick killer would not do. Like, he gives her a ring that has the murder victim's initials on it.
Yeah.
And I love how they set it up. They're like, what did he say? There's like a faint inscription or engraving or something. And then they show the ring and there's nothing faint about this inscription. Yeah. I know they have to do that because it's the camera and we need to see what it says. But I was like, my dude, like, yeah. I think you should have taken a second look at this ring before you gave it. So, he freaks out about the paper. He gives someone a ring with the initials of the murder victim. He's not a slick killer. We'll say that much.
No. He's a downright narcissist in the sense of he does all these things and he wants to, in a way, kind of brag about it. But, you know, he wants to show in the way he, like, when he goes into the bank and he's open with, like, how much money he's putting in. Like, in a way, like, he certainly, like you said, he's not slick, but he to me, he is. He's a stereotypical narcissist where wants everyone to see him in a certain light, which I think kind of gets into, like, why he hates these widows, because, like, in his eyes, they are where they are because of who they married, and they don't deserve it, and he feels that he does, and that's kind of his... Yeah. I think there was a bit of, like, in a sense of, I think there is some subtlety there compared to something like Rope, not to, like, bashing on a movie, but where there wasn't that was kind of lacking for those characters. Here, I thought, I don't know, I did like his character more as it went through, because I agree, as, like, some of those decisions early on seemed a little bit questionable, but as we learned more about him, I thought it all kind of made sense, and understanding of, like, where he is and just kind of the odd fellow he turned out to be.
And I think they do a good job. I appreciate that they do give the backstory of him having the injury as a child on his, I think it was a bike injury or something like that. And obviously this story, if you do the research and look at the trivia, like, this is based on a real life murder, and that person similarly had, you know, an injury in his youth. And I guess the only thing that is somewhat questionable about that backstory, I do like it because it shows him more as a psychotic individual or a narcissist or different things like that. He's clearly got something wrong from a mental standpoint. This isn't just someone who's trying to get away with murder because whatever, like the guy in Rope, for example. But
it's not a leisure activity for him.
Yeah. Right. But I do think, like, I guess you have to then also accept the premise that he has been removed from this family for quite some time, because it would be rare for someone to have that injury as a child, go through the steps of becoming a psychotic individual, and never have anybody close to him see anything that's a little questionable.
Yeah.
Like, the way that this family is just head over heels about him and inviting him. It's not like, hey, Uncle Charlie's coming. you know, if he says anything funny, just ignore it or something. Like, there's nothing like that. It's like, this guy is, like, the best family member in the history of family members. And so I don't know. He must have hit it really well for the rest of his life prior to this. But it's not fair to critique the movie on that, because we don't get to see what happens, you know, prior to this event.
Plus, the family is a bit weird themselves. I do, like, that's, you know, true. You got the father and the other character that love, like, discussing murdering each other openly all the time. So,
which, by the way, were my two favorite characters in the film.
Yeah, I really thought that was gonna come into play more. Like, I was waiting for them, those mushrooms, to show up someplace, or
them to solve something or see something. Yeah. I guess he does help a little bit. The neighbor does, but I just thought the dialogue they give those two is hilarious, and what they're kind of going back and forth and trying to one up each other. The only thing that was really disturbing to me was how the neighbor would just show up. Like, there was just not a knock. There was no doorbell. Dude was just in the house with you.
Like, yeah.
He just had to turn the corner and be like, oh, there's dude. I don't know what his name was. Neighbor. Did he have a name? What was his name? Herbie.
Kirby. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was like
showing up.
He was like the bad sitcom neighbor, but not in a movie, you know, like that right. trope, like the Urkel or the, you know, what's the character's name in Full House that would just, it was always there.
I know who you're talking about. Kimmy.
Kimmy. Yeah. It was, you know, he was that character, but I guess, I don't know if you would say he's annoying, but he certainly was an odd duck.
To me, he was more like the guy from Home Improvement that was on the other side of the fence, but instead of being on the other side of the fence, he's in your house with you like, without any knowledge of how he got there. He's just there.
Trying to come up with ways to murder you. So that's so, yeah.
I wanted to get your take on a couple other characters because we do obviously have the family, which we just talked about. We have the neighbor Herbie, which we just talked about. Obviously the detective, which we've mentioned. We haven't spent a lot of time on the two siblings and then her classmates slash friends. And I kept waiting for something to tie in those characters more into the story. So we have her sister and her brother likes numbers and counting and doing all that kind of stuff, and her sister likes reading and comes across as, you know, fairly intelligent, that type of thing. But to me, I thought they were going to like do something so that those characters became more important to some aspect of the plot, and the more I like digest it after the fact, I don't know if those characters served a purpose in this film. Like, I feel like outside of adding to the family dynamic and like the idyllic life that we're portraying here, you could take the brother and the sister out of this film and it has no consequence on the film. Unless I'm just missing something, and even more so with her friends. So they come across like three of her friends, two of them we find walking together a couple different times, and then one of them is maybe not a friend, but a classmate that serves them in the cafe, bar, restaurant, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And they make a point that, you know, all of these people have relationships with her and things of that nature. But then the same situation, like, what was the point of drawing that connection that they know each other and that they're friends or classmates outside of just, I guess, painting a picture of a small town where everybody knows each other? But none of those four or five characters did anything for the actual story to me, unless I'm missing something. Did you pick up more on something on those side characters?
I think it is part of just showcasing this town, understanding like the community there, seeing because where people are at, because you obviously have Charlie, that the bar scene that you mentioned, and then her person that's working there, that she clearly is a different path in life. And also you get some insight in Charlie in like what people view her as, because she says like, I never thought I would see you here. So it's clearly like she's someone that people view a certain way. The younger daughter, like, I think she provides some key like pieces of information about the library and like just like, you know, where the newspapers are, and I think partially too, I think she's there a little bit for comedic relief, but I don't think their purpose is necessarily more so for the overall narrative, just as you say, more of a representation of, as it was trying to kind of capture what life, like what an average life was like in this time, in order to set the stage. And what happens then when you take that average life and you bring in someone who's suspected for murder and giving like what would be the average family something to relate to, maybe putting in that headspace. So when they're seeing this, they're, you know, they're able to maybe try to have more of a connection to it because they can see their town, their life. And suddenly now there's their right. brother-in-law, whoever is there. Yeah. But like the friends and stuff like that, I don't think they're necessarily, you know, like you said, you could remove them narrative wise it doesn't change much, but I think it's more of a representation of
like the world building the setting that they're doing.
yeah
I guess world building is the wrong, but the picture they're painting, I guess, of the town. So I think overall from a positive standpoint, I like the time capsule of it. I like the way that they're painting the picture of this town, and then they're bringing something like Uncle Charlie in to disrupt it. I kind of like that all as a setting and a setup for it. I did like the father and the neighbor and kind of their banter back and forth. I enjoyed that. I do think the performances are fine between, you know, especially like you said, the two Charlies, I think work well off of each other from an acting standpoint. And he definitely is able to give like some psychotic eyes and some things of looks that definitely worked. The other thing that I think worked for me was kind of that last little bit where we get like a series of murder attempts from him. So we have the stairs that he's going to sabotage. We have the car in the garage that he's trying to trap her in. And then we have obviously the last sequence with the train. How did those three sequences work, or those three attempts work for you? And was it enough to kind of give you some suspense at the end? And was there anything else that you were positive on in this film?
I like those scenes. I think, like I said, that's where it started to come together, where it's like, he's willing to go all the way with this. Like, he's willing to take out his niece to protect himself. And that, I think it, I really like that bar scene too, where you see him kind of confront her. And I wondered, like, are you going to have this mystery where her finding out is the climax? But I did like the fact that she learns it and she discovers it, and suddenly the conflict becomes, does she say anything, because she knows saying something would destroy your family, like would completely wreck her mom, and it would kind of break them from the reality that they know, like what it would like. So now she has this guilt on top of everything. So I thought that was an intriguing dynamic. And so those scenes did work for me, because I think it that's when I really started getting invested in the film for the most part. And I think the performances overall, like you mentioned, which Joseph Cotton specifically, I thought was really good. And Trisha Wright, who I didn't honestly, like the films that she's known for, I have not seen. So I have not a lot of exposure to her, but I thought she played that role really well. And especially when she starts kind of to take charge, and she, you know, she tries to turn it a little bit, where she doesn't want to be the victim anymore. And I thought that's something you did not see all the time in films like during this era. So that was something a little bit different that I thought worked.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was pieces of this film that worked that make it overall not like something that I would keep away from. You know, I wouldn't dissuade someone from watching it. I don't think there's anything that's terrible about the film necessarily. I don't think the suspense worked as well for me for the first two thirds, probably, as I would have hoped it did, just because of how it's set up. And I thought there was some problematic things throughout, but like overall, I think there's enough to like pick up for something. I don't know how it has 100%. Like, that's a little bit baffling to me. And I don't know how it's Hitchcock's favorite film. Obviously, he knows more because he's behind the scenes and doing everything. So maybe it was just about the process and the in different things that kind of played into that. So I don't know if I'm as high as everybody else in the world is on this film, but I don't think it's a terrible film. I did find a couple things interesting. Films back in this day, obviously, we don't have TV yet, and we don't have internet and things of that nature. So the way that they would give you another chance to experience this was they would put on radio plays and things of that nature. And I did find it interesting that in one of the radio plays, they actually had Cary Grant play the role of Uncle Charlie. So
really?
yeah. So, and it was Cary Grant and Betsy Drake apparently played the other ones. And then most of the other ones, Joseph Cotton came back to play the other character, but it appeared in a bunch of different radio plays so that people could see it. It didn't get a good reception at first, like from a box office standpoint and a review. I think people were somewhat down on it at first, but what it's gotten from like the modern day critics and, you know, since Rotten Tomatoes and those types of websites exist, has obviously been overall very positive. Was there anything else about this film that you didn't get to touch on yet, or something else that you want to bring up that you either like or dislike?
Oh, we didn't mention the Hitchcock cameo. He is in he's on the train, holding. At first, I like he was holding. There's, you know, the he's basically holding the entire deck, and and the idea was that he's holding the entire deck because he's the director. I'll be honest, I thought it was supposed to be like a joke that he was cheating because he has all the cards, but it was supposed to be a reference to it. So, but yeah, you know, that was the one big cameo. And the other Hitchcockian pieces, I don't know, like, you know, this one doesn't have Someone's Wrongly Accused.
Not necessarily. Have, like, I guess it has a little bit of the, is he guilty, is he not? I mean, they establish it right away that he is, but at first it is going to be like, from the characters that are in the film, not from our standpoint, they don't know that he's guilty. So I guess that still exists in some way, shape, or form in this one.
Yeah, that's true. So.
And then I guess you have a mom. It's not the main character, like the main male's mom, but there is a mom involved in like what her reaction is going to be to all of this. I don't think it's at all what we've seen from other depictions of moms throughout Hitchcock's film. This is a much different. There's not anything abnormal about the relationship in this one, I don't think, with the mom and any of the characters. She's playing a pretty straightforward, standard, yeah. You know what I mean? Like a small town mom. So I don't get anything from that. Did you pick up any other Hitchcockian aspects?
No, that was pretty much it, which is interesting because you mentioned it being his favorite film, but a lot of his like key trademarks aren't here. Maybe that's why. I don't know. But that's all I found.
It is interesting as we're kind of going through that there seems to be a lot of like pairings that you can do with Hitchcock films, whether it be, you know what I mean? Like there's just like certain ones, like we talked about the 39 Steps and North by Northwest. Or, you know, different things that we've kind of been able to, and it seems like there's a lot of times there's something that he does earlier on in his filmography that then he like revisits in a slightly different way later with maybe more success. So it's kind of interesting how he kind of goes back and revisits certain tropes or certain things that he's tried and then just kind of does it a little different, or whether he's trying to improve on it or something. But I think it would be interesting once you've seen them all, like how many you can kind of pair up or match up as. It's like, well, this is the early version of this movie later on. So
yeah.
I find that somewhat interesting.
Alrighty.
All right. So that is 1943's Shadow of a Doubt. Middling review, I guess, but not terrible. Not probably going to end up on either one of our top film of the Hitchcock filmography. I think that's safe to say for the most part. So next up is going to be 1944's Lifeboat, which is a limited setting film that, Dan, I believe this one you have seen before?
I have seen, it was about 10 years ago, so I don't remember much of it, but yeah, I have seen this one before.
So you're going to come in with at least a little bit of knowledge, or maybe some things will refresh your memory as you start watching. I have not seen Lifeboat or know anything about it outside of what you've talked about throughout our filmography episode. So it'll be interesting to get into Lifeboat from 1944 and see how that kind of compares to what else we have talked about. Dan, if people want to get in contact with you or figure out other stuff that you're doing on social media, how would they do that?
Just search Comic Concierge and all the different social media platforms. You'll be able to find me there.
All right. You can search me out at Optimus Solo, or you can search the show out at the Cinema Geeks podcast, or we have a X page, and that's about it for the social media for the show, but you can definitely get in contact with us there, or you can check out all the other things Geekcast Radio related on the Geekcast Radio network, as far as all the other content, podcast articles, and videos that they put out on that website. So that does it for this episode. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more of the Cinema Geeks.